Have you ever walked into a room, maybe it's a dinner party, or even just scrolling through a comment section online, and felt like you were watching two completely different species try to communicate?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, not just disagreeing on, tax policy or zoning laws, but like they are operating in entirely different realities.
Totally different logic.
Right, and just looking at each other with this weird mix of confusion and deep suspicion.
It's that classic ships passing in the night phenomenon, or maybe battleships firing into the fog. It is a very human problem.
It really is. And usually we just shrug and say, well, that's politics. But today we are taking a deep dive into a source that suggests this fracture goes way, way deeper than the latest election cycle.
Yeah, we're looking at a lecture. It's titled Philosophy Today and Tomorrow by Dr. Arthur Holmes.
And we should set the stage for you here because this isn't just some random polished TED talk.
No, not at all. This recording is actually the final lecture of a history of philosophy course at Wheaton College. So imagine you are a student sitting in that room. You've spent the whole semester slogging through Plato, Aristotle, Kant, Nietzsche. And now it is the last day.
The grand finale.
Exactly. Holmes is essentially giving you the State of the Union address for the entire world of ideas.
He's looking back at the landscape of the 20th century and asking, where do we stand right now? And more importantly, where is this whole thing going?
And what's really refreshing about this source is that he doesn't treat philosophy like this pristine museum exhibit behind glass. He describes a history of ideas as, and I love this quote, a bull session that never finishes.
I have to say, that description makes me feel a lot better about some of my own late night arguments.
It really frames the discipline not as a dusty library, but as a living, messy
It
conversation.
is messy. And our mission today is to unpack that mess. We're going to look at the massive divides in Western thought, this really surprising resurgence of religious philosophy in a secular world, and how the real world basically forced philosophers to get practical.
So let's start with the geography of Holmes's map. He identifies this massive crack running right down the center of modern philosophy.
The Great Divide.
Right. He calls it the split between continental thought and analytic thought. If you were a philosophy student back then, you pretty much had to pick a side.
Okay, so on one side you have the continental tradition, which he notes is mostly French and German, rooted in phenomenology.
Yeah.
And then on the other side, the Anglo-American world, the UK and the US, dominated by analytic philosophy.
That's the setup.
But let's move past just the geography for a second. If I pick up a book, how do I actually know which one I'm holding? Is it just a difference in authors, or are they using their brains different?
It's a fundamental difference in methodology. It's about what they think a philosopher's job actually is. Holmes explains that the phenomenologist, the continental thinker, is trying to show you the truth.
Show me. Like a tour guide.
In a way, yeah. It's descriptive, almost literary. They want to describe a human experience like angst or freedom or boredom so vividly that you look at it and say, aha, I see it.
Oh, I get it. Like, that is what it means to be alive.
Precisely. They are appealing directly to your intuition. They want you to recognize a shared experience.
So they're painting a picture of existence.
Right. Now, contrast that with the analytic philosopher. They are definitely not trying to paint a picture. They're more like engineers.
Or mechanics.
Exactly. They care about rigorous analysis of concepts, defining terms perfectly, and the logical chain of an argument. They want a proof.
Not a portrait.
Right.
So the analytic philosopher is the guy who stops you mid-sentence at a party to ask, wait, how are you defining the word angst in that premise?
That is exactly who they are. And you can see why these two camps wouldn't exactly get along.
Yeah, one's writing poetry about the soul, and the other is demanding the math that proves the soul is a necessary variable.
And Holmes notes they speak with real disparagement of one another. The field was totally politicized.
He mentions university departments were basically segregated, right?
Completely. You'd have a school like Duquesne University that was overwhelmingly phenomenological. But then most other major American departments were strictly analytic, and they actively looked down on each other.
But Holmes does imply these lines were getting a little loose by the time he gave the lecture. He tells this great story about himself that shows the labels aren't as rigid as people thought.
Yeah, the Northern Illinois University anecdote. Holmes didn't consider himself a hardcore analytic philosopher. He was just presenting a paper, trying to think his way through a specific puzzle.
But because he was breaking concepts down carefully,
Right, because he's using logic, a colleague came up to him afterward and said, "Well, you are an analyst."
so they just slapped the label on him because he was making sense.
Pretty much. Holmes makes the point that Analytic eventually just became a synonym for doing philosophy carefully. But he warns his students the tribalism was still there. If you wanted a job in an American university, you had to play the analytic game.
You couldn't just write poetic essays and get tenure.
Nope. Unless you were one of the rare birds he mentions, like Richard Rorty or Hubert Dreyfus.
They kept a foot in both camps, right?
Yeah, drawing on Wittgenstein and Foucault at the same time. But they were very much the exceptions.
Okay, so we have this stylistic split poets versus engineers. But what were they actually believing? Because Holmes gives us a snapshot of the dominant worldview in the university, and it is monolithic.
Very. He establishes that the default setting, the air the Western Academy breathes, is scientific naturalism.
Also known as secular humanism.
Right. The baseline assumption is that the natural world is all there is. Science is the only reliable tool for finding truth.
And things like religion, ethics, art.
Those are just cultural artifacts or subjective feelings. They aren't knowledge in the strict sense.
Which feels like the standard story of the 20th century, right? God is dead, science won, end of story.
But this is where Holmes throws in a plot twist I did not see coming.
The theistic surprise.
Yeah, he points out a massive anomaly, specifically within the philosophy of religion.
This part of the lecture really makes you sit up. He takes us back to a conference in the 1950s.
Right, where a young Catholic philosopher named James Ross gives a paper arguing for God's existence.
And how did the room take that?
Poorly. Holmes remembers the hallway chatter. People weren't just debating Ross's logic. They were totally dismissive. He heard people saying, you know, it couldn't possibly be true or there must be a trick in his argument.
Like the very concept was intellectually dead.
Exactly. Treated like someone arguing the Earth is flat. But then, flash forward just 15 years.
Same hotel, same conference.
Yes. And Holmes is chairing a panel on the problem of evil. On the panel is a group of confessed Christians, evangelicals, and Catholics.
And the room was empty.
Packed. Standing room only, yeah. Spilling out into the hallway.
So in the span of one academic career, God went from a taboo subject to the headliner.
In that specific subfield, yes. Holmes notes that Christian theism actually became the dominant force within Anglo-American philosophy of religion. He lists heavy hitters like Alvin Plantinga and Nicholas Wolterstorff.
And these weren't fringe guys. They became presidents of the American Philosophical Association.
Right. It's a fascinating counter-narrative.
But we should clarify the scope here. Holmes isn't saying the entire university suddenly found religion.
No. That's a crucial nuance. Scientific naturalism still ruled the broader Rust metaphysics, epistemology. But in that one specific corner where people ask questions about God, the believers took the lead.
It's almost like a rebel base inside the secular empire.
That's a good way to put it.
But speaking of rebels, we have to talk about the new challenger rising up right around this time. The P word.
Postmodernism.
The ultimate bogeyman of the late 20th century. Usually when older academics talk about postmodernism, there's this sheer panic. You know, truth is dead, everything is relative, the sky is falling.
But Holmes is incredibly calm about it. He actually calls it old hat with new trim.
Old hat with new trim. I really appreciate the lack of hysteria there. Why does he think it's nothing new?
Well, he's taking the long view as a historian. He traces this kind of anti-realism all the way back to the Sophists in ancient Greece and then to David Hume in the 1700s.
So he sees it as cyclical.
Exactly. Confident systems of thought build up. They eventually collapse when we realize we can't prove everything perfectly. And we go through a phase of relativistic panic. This is just the newest cycle.
Ah, but he does clarify that this new version has a different flavor than David Hume's skepticism. In the Q&A section, he distinguishes between a mechanical model and an organic model.
Yes, that's a key insight. Think about David Hume. He was reacting to Newtonian physics, a clockwork universe. So his skepticism was mechanical. He asked, how can we actually know billiard ball A caused billiard ball B to move?
Right. It was all about cause and effect inside a machine.
But postmodernism relies on a relational, organic model. It argues that everything is interconnected, like an ecosystem.
And because you are part of that ecosystem, you can't step outside of it to look at it objectively.
Exactly. It's not just, I can't know if the sun will rise tomorrow. It's, I can't know anything objectively because I am trapped inside my context.
My race, my gender, my economic class.
Right. Those things determine how I think. I can't step out of my own skin to see the capital T truth.
It essentially politicizes knowledge. It changes the debate from, is this true, to whose power interests does this serve?
And Holmes predicts, and keep in mind he said this decades ago, that while this would be a hot topic for a decade or two, it wouldn't actually replace scientific naturalism.
And he was largely right about that. Science is still the gold standard. We didn't stop building airplanes or vaccines because of postmodernism.
True. But that deep skepticism about neutrality, that stuck around. And that perfectly sets up Holmes's next big observation. The massive shift from metaethics to applied ethics.
This is where philosophy finally stops staring at its own navel.
Yes. Holmes points out that for 40 or 50 years, ethics was completely paralyzed. Philosophers were obsessed with metaethics. They only asked questions like, what does the word good actually mean?
Or is a moral statement just an expression of your emotions?
Right. So if you asked a philosopher, is this war wrong? They'd say, well, first, we must define what you mean by wrong.
And by the time they finished defining the terms, the war is over.
It was entirely abstract. But then the 1960s happened.
The real world came knocking. The Vietnam War, the draft.
Holmes uses Wheaton as a microcosm for this. In the 50s, they didn't even have an applied ethics course. It wasn't considered real philosophy.
But when the draft hit, students were agonizing.
They were terrified of being sent to kill people in a war they thought was immoral. They didn't need a definition of good. They needed to make a real decision.
Real life basically forced the door open.
It did. Holmes started a course on war and Christian ethics, and the demand was just insatiable. And look at the field today. Applied ethics, bioethics, business ethics, AI ethics. It's a massive industry.
Philosophy literally had to become useful to survive. You can only argue about definitions for so long when people are actually dying.
And within that revival, Holmes spots another major trend, virtue ethics. He mentions Alasdair MacIntyre here.
Which is a move away from just like a flowchart of morality.
Right, away from just rules and decision-making and back to the character of the person. It brings concepts like sin, grace, and habit back into the conversation.
It asks what kind of person would do this, rather than just asking if the action is rule compliant.
Exactly. It's about who you are, not just what you do.
So we've surveyed this whole landscape, the analytic continental split, the dominance of naturalism with that theistic pocket, the cycles of postmodernism, and the boom in applied ethics.
It's a lot of ground.
It is. And Holmes wraps it all up by offering a sort of roadmap for his students. He calls it Christian philosophy, but honestly, looking at the source, it reads like a solid methodology for anyone trying to think clearly while holding strong beliefs.
It's really a framework for intellectual honesty. He outlines four pillars. The first one attacks that idea of neutrality we just talked about. He says philosophy must be perspectival.
Which means what exactly? Because perspectival sounds a bit relativistic.
He just means we need to stop lying to ourselves. He argues that total neutrality is a myth, a self-deception.
So you can't completely disconnect from your background or values when you approach a problem.
No. You should fess up, as he puts it, acknowledge that your worldview influences your reasoning. It's actually more honest, more objective, to admit your bias than to pretend you're a robot.
That clears the air beautifully. What's the second pillar?
It must be exploratory. This goes right back to the bull session idea. Philosophy is a process, not a finished product.
Yeah.
If you think you've got the universe wrapped up in a tidy box, you aren't doing philosophy anymore.
You're just reciting a creed.
Exactly.
And the third?
Pluralistic. He insists we need a diversity of thought. We need people who disagree with us because, and this is a great phrase, humans are wonderful bunglers.
Wonderful bunglers. I love that. I feel very seen.
It implies that even our best thinking is prone to error. If everyone around you agrees with you, you can tunnel vision. You need the friction of disagreement to correct your blind spots.
And the fourth pillar.
Holistic. Don't just look at one slice of the pie. See how your worldview integrates with science, art, history. Don't specialize in one tiny fragment and ignore the rest of reality.
And that holistic approach ties right into his final advice on stewardship. Usually people use that word for money or the environment, but he applies it to your career.
It's very pragmatic. He tells the students not to just flock to the popular fields. Philosophy of religion was crowded because of that theistic surprise.
Everyone wanted to be the next Plantinga.
Right. But Holmes says the room is full. He urges them to go into neglected fields. Aesthetics. Philosophy of science.
Go where the need is greatest, not where the applause is loudest.
Exactly. Treat your intellect as a resource to be deployed strategically. It changes the question from, what do I enjoy? To where can I be useful?
That is such a refreshing take. It makes intellectual work feel like a genuine mission.
And that leads right to his closing sentiment. He turns to the students in the room, and really to anyone listening, and talks about the future.
He makes this profound point that the future of philosophy isn't some abstract destiny written in the stars. It's not determined by vague historical forces.
No, it's determined by ordinary people.
The people sitting in that room.
He mentions future college presidents and writers, sure, but he also points to people who stay entirely outside of professional academia. History is made by the participants.
It's a very empowering way to end a grueling history course. You aren't just observing the bull session, you are sitting in the circle.
We all are. Whether you're writing a dissertation or debating a policy at work or just talking with a neighbor, you are part of the ecosystem.
So here is a question for you to chew on as we wrap up. Holmes argued that total neutrality is a myth, that we all bring a specific perspective that colors how we see reality.
And that we are wonderful bunglers who desperately need other perspectives to correct us.
If that's true, when you listen to the news today, or talk to your boss, or even listen to this deep dive, what perspective are you bringing that you might not even be aware of?
What are the invisible glasses you're wearing that change the color of everything you see?
And if you took them off, or at least admitted you were wearing them, would the world look any different? Something to think about. Thanks for diving in with us today.
Until next time.